From WGCU, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. The story of a badly injured dog who was rescued late last year from a suspected dogfighting ring caught the attention of the right people, scientists at Arthrex. They'd just developed a cutting-edge type of wound dressing called Jumpstart, which they thought just might help the 3-year-old dog named Abigail. They contacted the veterinarian treating the dog, donated the special bandaging, and it sped her healing remarkably. Today, we'll talk with the people who developed this high-tech wound dressing about its applications to humans and pets, and we'll meet Abigail and her rescuer to hear about her recovery. Plus, corruption across the globe is a threat not only to the people who live in corrupt nations, but a researcher who's worked in Afghanistan says it damages the environment and even enables terrorism. We'll talk with Sarah Chase about her upcoming talk at FGCU about the dangers of corruption at home and abroad. But first, the news. Our next guest is a former international correspondent for NPR who founded a nonprofit in Afghanistan before working with senior military officials there to help rebuild that country. She's now a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and an international authority on corruption and its implications. She's the author of Thieves of State: Why Corruption Threatens Global Security. On Friday, she'll be having a talk at FGCU entitled Systemic Corruption and Its Dangers at Home and Abroad. Sarah Chase, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
I'm so happy to be on WGCU.
Well, we're glad to have you. We're talking about corruption with author and researcher Sarah Chase. Have you experienced corruption locally or internationally? Share your thoughts at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK on Facebook. We're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we are at WGCU using the hashtag GCO. Sarah Chase, you were a journalist for NPR covering Europe and the Kosovo crisis when you found yourself covering Afghanistan in 2002. That was a pivotal moment for you in your career. What did you see? What happened that made you want to stay in Afghanistan?
You know, it wasn't specific to Afghanistan. It was, you know, that was a pivotal moment for all of us, right? It was the immediate post 9/11 time. And it seemed to me that this was one of those turning points in history, sort of like the assassination of the Archduke, you know, that set off the First World War, that kind of can be said to be have been the beginning of the 20th century. I said, wow, this event will be the marking event of the 21st century. And where else should I put my time and energy than right there where it happened? So that's really what decided me to kind of leave my journalism career behind and try to do something.
So a lot of your discussion about corruption kind of focuses on the Middle East and what was called, later referred to as the Arab Spring. For people that aren't familiar, can you give us a little summary of why the Arab Spring was such a big deal and what kind of a turning point you saw prior to that?
Well, actually, my thinking about corruption predates that moment. It really came from right there on the ground in Afghanistan, where I opened in the end a little soap factory, right? So I was doing manufacturing on the ground in Kandahar, which had been the Taliban heartland. But when I first came in there, you know, right after, in the days after the fall of the Taliban, nobody in town was happy with that regime, right? They were so thrilled to be done with the Taliban. What I observed over the following years was that the government of Afghanistan that the United States was supporting was so corrupt and was so abusive to the citizens. And what I mean by that is you couldn't interact with a government official, be it a police officer, be it trying to get your driver's license, someone I knew who was, you know, had to get the death certificate for his father who had been blown up in one of those improvised bombs. You couldn't interact with a government official without being shaken down. And they don't shake you down politely. Like, they don't say, you know what, my salary's really rotten and I've got 4 kids at home, so could you help me out a bit? Like, it's arrogant, it's contemptuous. And I watch people getting angrier and angrier at that until by about 2005, 2006, people actually started welcoming the Taliban back again, not for religious ideological reasons, which you would have thought, but instead because they almost couldn't tell the difference between the way the Taliban treated them and the way the Karzai government and U.S.-backed Karzai government was treating them. In fact, they remembered the Taliban as being harsh and stern, but not corrupt. And so what I saw was it was the corruption of the government that was driving people toward religious extremism. And that was a really, it was kind of counterintuitive. Then we get to early 2011 when a whole bunch of Arabic countries across North Africa and into the Middle East sort of go off like fireworks. You know, it started in Tunisia, it spread across to Libya and Egypt, Morocco, they were in the street, and then Yemen and Jordan, they were in the street. Yemen also, the government was overturned. I mean, it was about half a dozen countries that went into insurrection. By that time, I was working actually as a special assistant to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And as these events started to unfold very quickly, I said, boss, you know, I give you ground truth on Afghanistan. Send me across North Africa and let me kind of report back to you what I'm seeing from the ground. And it wasn't, you know, more than a couple hours. And I started in the West and moved east. So I started in Morocco and moved all the way across North Africa over the course of a month. It was obvious to me that what people were revolting against was corruption. I mean, I had been in Morocco as a youngster, as a Peace Corps volunteer, and we couldn't even use the word king or the name of the king. I was looking at demonstrations where people had signs, you know, showing the faces of government ministers behind bars, saying these people need to be put in jail because they're stealing, you know, they're looting the commons, if you will. And that was a remarkable, I was stunned.
Well, a good friend of mine is from Egypt, and she encountered this same kind of thing where you get shaken down every time you're trying to get anything done, trying to get a passport, you have to pay a bribe. Did you see the same thing in Afghanistan throughout the Middle East, going all the way over to Egypt and Morocco? But then after the Arab Spring, did you see any improvements in that? Did you see the new regimes coming into power that were any less corrupt?
Well, I think that's a great question. And it sort of goes to the answer basically is no. But let me kind of unpack that a little bit. When people are driven to extremes, sometimes they're not actually looking, you know, they're not selecting between two varieties of toothpaste and like which is the one that's most likely to fight cavities. By the time they get driven to such extremes that they're joining a violent extremist movement or they're rising up in revolution against their government, you know, they're kind of past the point of careful comparisons between two options. They're looking in a way for a wrecking ball. They're trying to bring down the system. And the fact is that revolutions throughout history have rarely produced a much better alternative than the regime against which the revolution took place, at least not immediately. And I think that's a point where we Americans need to stop for a second and remember our own revolution, right? I mean, I grew up in the Boston area in New England, and so we were always really proud of our, you know, 18th century past. But, you know, the American revolutions more or less started in 1775. We didn't even have a constitution that you know, we could function with until 1788. So we're talking at least 13 years, right? The Arab Spring only happened 5 or 6 years ago, and the sociological and political context is way more complex than what we were dealing with back in the 18th century. So I do think you need to give these huge political transformations a little bit of time to mature. But I also think that my analysis actually has some relevance to the United States.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to get to. So, I mean, if we have the corrupt regimes in countries half a world away, how does that have an impact on some of us in, you know, Florida or Washington, D.C.?
So there are two ways that I think this has an impact on us. One, a way that I have been looking at a lot over the years has been, you know, how are we in the West either wittingly or unwittingly facilitating or enabling these type of regimes. And one of the really obvious ways is through basically helping corrupt officials move their money and spend their money on assets. And so you've got a lot of U.S. banks that, you know, have been facilitating the moving of corrupt money. There's been an increased crackdown on that kind of thing. But real estate is another really important asset where corrupt officials like to put their money, either at home or abroad. I don't know if you happen to remember the pictures that went online after the fall of the corrupt ruler of Ukraine, Yanukovych, and he had this kind of pleasure palace, and it even freaked out Ukrainians who knew how corrupt he was. But, you know, Florida real estate is one of the places. I've been working on Honduras for the last, almost last year. Florida real estate is one of the places where some of this money goes. So to some extent, there's a facilitation impact. There's also a real estate market impact. I haven't looked closely at the real estate market in Florida, but in London, for example, regular, even wealthy Londoners simply cannot afford the property market in London anymore because so many Russian oligarchs and criminals and corrupt officials are parking their money in the London real estate market. So facilitation is one way, but let me be even a little bit more provocative. Our electoral campaign was characterized by use of the word corruption in a way that I've never heard it used before in America, and that was both on the right and on the left. Candidates really galvanized voters by talking about the corruption of the American political system. And I actually think that there was a point to that. I mean, when I look at the level of kind of collusion between critical industries that maximize profits, meaning defense, energy, pharma, banking. And when I say profits, I don't mean kind of legitimate profit. I mean illegitimately, or maybe not illegally, not always illegally, but often illegally.
But unethically?
Yes, certainly unethically. And I think in the context of the banking industry, we can really say it was illegal. There was massive fraud that led to the financial crisis of 2008. There was a decision made not to really prosecute that fraud. But there's absolutely no doubt that fraud on a massive scale and to very high levels in a lot of these financial institutions was being perpetrated.
In the American, I'm sorry, I don't want to interrupt
you. Yeah,
in
please.
The American psyche, though, the idea of corruption is just, it seems foreign.
That's a great point.
You don't think of Americans being corrupt or championing any kind of corruption, whereas in some of these other countries, the corruption goes top down and it goes into an individual psychological state of being, whereas in America, it's kind of hard for us to wrap our heads around that.
I think that's a really important point. And again, it's kind of contradictory. So you're right. We don't like often think of ourselves as being corrupt. And yet, way more than half of the electorate that voted was motivated by that issue, based on if you add Trump voters together with Bernie Sanders voters, those were the two candidates who put the most emphasis on corruption. So there are a lot of Americans who are concerned about corruption in America, but they're understanding it in a different way. And that's what your question really highlights, is that we're not getting shaken down by police by the side of the road. We don't have to pay bribes to teachers so that they pay attention to our children. On the other hand, we do have a sense, so it's not vertically integrated in the same way as it is in Afghanistan or Nigeria or Uzbekistan or Honduras, the countries that I've been studying overseas. But the role of the industries that I mentioned in determining the rules of the game in America, the degree to which they are writing those rules, and the degree to which our prosecution, our punishment is skewed, so our enforcement of the rules is skewed. I mean, we're a country with 4 million Americans in jail. They're in jail for largely, frankly, trivial offenses, sometimes reaching the level of murder, but very often below that level of criminal offense. Meanwhile, you have an industry that threw another 4 million Americans out in the street through mortgage foreclosures. And I have not seen a commensurate level of enforcement being applied to that industry as is being applied to street level crime. That, you know, that means that our rules are being unfairly enforced. And I think it's largely to do with this overlap between certain elements of the private sector and public office.
And in order to do something about that, the general public, maybe they're more fearful of street level crime than they are of corporate crime, or what you were describing with the housing situation. So perception wise, they may not see it as a criminal situation. That would probably, I would imagine, be something you'd have to go from the top down.
Yes. And what I find really interesting is you, as I say, you had two different candidates who were emphasizing the issue of corruption, accurately identifying the existence of corruption within senior U.S. decision making. But you had two very different answers to that problem. The answer that got into the White House is the one that further focuses people's attention on street level crime, on immigrants.
On the more visceral reactionary.
That's right. Visceral, visible types of crime, while actually reinforcing the type of high-level collusion that I mentioned before. So you now have the former CEO of ExxonMobil, which is quite an important, I would say, facilitator and enabler of corruption overseas. You've got him now running the State Department. And we could go through a number of these other appointments, but you also have, you know, again, the almost shameless, I would like to say, use of political office to promote personal gain on the part of the president and his family. Again, this isn't entirely new. I think that the issues that were raised with the Clinton Foundation were very significant issues. The idea that a Secretary of State of the United States is allowing foreign governments to provide donations to a foundation with her name on it. Now, again, those weren't gifts to her personally, so it didn't violate U.S. law, but it certainly smells of the type of corruption that I see overseas. So it's not new with the Trump administration, but I do see an almost, it's almost as though the gloves of it have come off.
Yes, it's definitely out there and out loud. And you mentioned earlier ExxonMobil, and I wanted to talk about large American players, corporate players, doing business overseas in places that are corrupt. Do a lot of them see corruption and paying off bribes, things like that? Do they see that as the cost of doing business? And next to that, is it possible for a large corporation like that to go into a corrupt society or corrupt government and try to lead by example by setting out its contracts in a way that says they will not put up with that type of corruption?
The answer to the first part is largely yes. I think that U.S., especially major corporations, have been very recalcitrant about U.S. legislation that prohibits bribing foreign governments. In fact, the first rule to get rolled back since the Trump administration has been inaugurated has been the rule requiring oil and gas companies to simply declare any payments they make to foreign governments. And that means legal payments. That means, you know, royalties and permitting and anything like that. They wish to keep those payments secret. I don't understand what the business interest is, except the ability to potentially shield payments that might be considered to be bribes. So they are very recalcitrant about these rules. I believe, on the other hand, that business with integrity, number one, does have a competitive advantage, and there's some experience to that effect in the mining industry, which not so much on corruption, but on environment and on safety standards, actually has come together and set a higher standard. And I've spoken to past presidents of the International Commission on Metals and Mining who have said it actually proved to be a competitive advantage. But there's a further implication to all of this, which is something, you know, something that's come to be called the resource curse. So when you make payments to corrupt governments, and in the case of Nigeria, for example, which I know quite well, there was at least a period where the Nigerian government was siphoning $1 billion a month out of its oil revenues. So that money was not reaching the government coffers, the treasury.
Wow.
That was during 2012 and 2013, and there's no indication that it changed under that president. Anyhow, we're talking gigantic amounts of money. There's a downward spiral that we have been able to document here, which goes from economic dysfunction to precursors of violence to, so it's underdevelopment, economic de-diversification, precursors of violence, mm-hmm. and then a breakdown into various types of insurrection.
And does this lead then to terrorism?
It can. So in Nigeria, it has. You have terrorism in the north, and you have a kind of very locally focused anti-oil industry insurrection in the south. And both of those are due to the corruption that is fueled by this type of energy and extractive contracts. So interestingly, we, the United States, have had to send, you know, military advisors. We haven't put troops on the ground in Nigeria, but we have had to spend our budget fighting or working against the insurgencies that arise as the result of this type of corruption. And part of me wants to say, well, where is Shell and ExxonMobil paying for our troops that we're sending over there? In other words, there's a level of corporate social responsibility. There's a cost to doing business that way that is not being assumed by the company or its shareholders.
But the U.S. government and foreign policies ends up paying with it.
That's right. That's right.
So do you think this is something that can be addressed on a legislative level? Or is it just calling out for people to have personal and corporate responsibility?
I do think there's a lot of legislation that can be applied to this. I also think there are a number of executive branch tools that could be applied to it. And I've kind of listed a lot of the tools that exist in the toolbox in my book, Thieves of State. The reason that I don't talk about a particular remedy is I feel quite strongly that these are networks. They are, in effect, criminal networks that need to be studied as such. And then you select the tools that you want to use against the network based on its structure, its mode of operations, you know, the revenue streams that it happens to capture. You know, so there's a degree of tailoring of remedies. But yes, there are legislative remedies. There are executive branch remedies. I think development actors and foreign direct investors need to be thinking much harder about precisely where they're spending their money or making their investments.
And looking at what happens next.
Yeah, to avoid reinforcing these types of networks.
And we're about out of time, but you're speaking at FGCU on Friday. I could talk forever about this, but we're speaking at FGCU on Friday, and the title of your talk is Systemic Corruption and Its Dangers at Home and Abroad. Can you tell me just quickly about the at-home part of the talk? What kind of corruption are you addressing about here in the United States?
Well, I'm really talking about what I just mentioned. I mean, I'm talking about this level of overlap between public function and private gain, which in my view is very it has been one of the drivers of the sort of significantly increasing income inequality that we're suffering in this country. That's not just structural. That's because the rules are being written in favor of these very select industries that are dominating the public function and have come to dominate them even more now than they did, you know, 6 months ago. And I think the American public is quite indignant over this. And I'm not sure that we will be very tranquil as this is reinforced in our country.
Okay, well, we have to leave it there for today. But I want to thank you for talking with us today. Sarah Chase with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She'll be speaking Friday at FGCU. Promises to be quite interesting. You can get the details of her talk on our website at wgcunews.org. Our show today was produced by Matthew Smith and directed by Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.